Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about the play I Take Your Hand in Mine and about the film Playground. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Mark Cousins. His film, The First Movie, opens this Friday, the 3rd of June, at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm glad to be here.
So you went to the village of Göktepe in Iraq. It's the Kurdish part of Iraq that you went to. How did you find this place? How did you go there and decide to make a film there?
Well, good question. I had traveled in the Middle East a lot and had loved all the different bits, Iran and Israel and Syria and many different bits. So I wanted to make a film that captured some of the vitality of this place and, you could say, provide a different image to what we normally see on our TV about the Middle East. So my producer and I went there to the car, drove around for 10 days, just looking. When you're a filmmaker, you know, you're looking for something visual, and I was looking for a microcosm, a small place from which I could try and tell a biggish story, perhaps. And we went to towns and cities, and then we came across this beautiful, tragic, magnificent village called Göktepe, and I just thought this is where we should set our story.
It's a village of 700 people. Describe to us a little bit what it's like.
It's on a hillside, on a precipice, and it's full. It's one and two-story buildings, a little bit of electricity, loads of sheep and goats and cows and geese. It's on a river, and when you look down from the hill, you see the river snaking and southwards in the distance towards what we call Mesopotamia. So it's an ancient part of the world, a very beautiful part of the world. The richer families, and they're not really rich, but the richer families live in a bit that they call Beverly Hills. And that means they've got a bit of grass and a small television set. Really warm, really friendly, one little shop, a mosque, etc. Very nice.
Now, you focused very much on the children there, and the film has a kind of a magical childlike vision in many ways, and you draw on your own sensibilities as a child in Belfast. Tell us that connection between your own past and then these children.
Well, you know, sometimes when you start to make something or do something, you don't really know where the journey will lead. Well, I didn't know in this case. I knew it was about village. I knew it was about a great part of the world. I knew I wanted to make something about kids and their vitality. But only when I got there and I noticed the way that the kids deal with war and the past, that did it start to ring bells in my head. I thought, this sounds familiar. And it took me about, shows you how slow I am, but it took me about a week to realize that I was really identifying with them. I grew up in a low-temperature war in Northern Ireland, and I remember how easy it was to switch between real fear and a kind of joy. You know, it was almost like kids can just flick a switch so quickly, and that's what these fantastic kids were doing in Kurdish Iraq, and that's what it really reminded me of.
Now, you actually brought a projector and showed them films, which is a very beautiful thing. We see this in your film. How did you decide what you were going to show them, and how did they respond to it?
Well, I knew I didn't speak their language, Sorani Kurdish, and they didn't speak mine. But I know there is this international language called cinema, so I thought if I bring some films along. I brought a very famous American film called E.T., which everyone, of course, has seen, and they loved that. But I knew it would be wrong to bring only Western films, because there are great movies from around the world. So I showed a fantastic Iranian film called The Boot, about a little girl who loses her boot, and then her friend helps her find it. And then I showed a film from Denmark called Palle Alone in the World, and it's about a boy who grows up to discover that all the adults are gone. There are no adults left, and so he can, like, drive he can go on trains, and he can take an airplane to the moon, etc. So I brought what I thought were the best films for kids from around the world. and the kids just screamed and yelled when they came to see the movies. Most of them had not, none of them had seen a movie before. And we advertised the screening at 7:30. About 100 of them arrived at 6:30 and just sat patiently waiting. So we had to entertain them. And then they shrieked and danced and cheered. I've been showing films now for 20 more years, and I've never seen such an enthusiastic response.
I noticed watching the film that the girls and boys lived pretty separate lives. Is that actually true?
Once they get to a certain age, you can imagine around 11 or 12, then there's a real separation. You'll have noticed there are. I wanted as many girls as possible in the movie. You'll have noticed that there are some, and it tends to be the more confident girls. You know, the girls with a real sense of humour and style in themselves. So the lovely little girl called Mushta and her gang, and they were unstoppable, and they were everywhere, and they were a lot of fun. But there are different. I mean, it is a traditional part of the world, and as the girls get a little older, things change. And but the girls, there's a little scene in the film where I talk about the prospects for these girls, you know, and I say to them, you know, you could be president of this land, you know. So Kurdistan is reasonably modern compared to some of the very traditional bits of the Middle East, and so mixed feelings about that.
Did they think they could be president? How did they react when you said that?
Yeah, they thought that. I mean, they were very interested in the equipment, the cameras and everything. I really, really wanted the girls to do most of the filming, but the girls also wanted to be on camera, in front of the camera, as well as behind the camera, you know. And yeah, I think that, you know, some of the girls were shy, but little Mushta took very well. She told me she wanted to be a head teacher at her school. So she's got plans for herself.
We're talking to Mark Cousins about his film, which is called The First Movie. Now, you not only showed them films, but you brought cameras for
yes.
these children. What
yes.
did they end up shooting? Tell us about some of the things that you saw.
All sorts of things, you know, lots of things that children in Santa Fe or here where I am in Scotland would shoot, you know, football matches and play. Because there's a river in the village, lots of them jumped in the river with the camera, which made me laugh. But also they did some very serious stuff that children everywhere wouldn't do, which is they went to the older ladies in the village and interviewed them about what happened way back in the 80s when this village was gassed by Saddam Hussein. And these interviews were very, very good indeed, I thought. And then there was one, in addition to that, there was one little boy who just trained his camera on another little boy who's playing in the mud, as you saw in the film. And he gave a very poetic little commentary over it, which I just thought was great. I've been making films for more than 20 years, and I haven't done anything as good as this little boy did. Slightly annoying, that, obviously.
Yeah, it's so interesting to watch what kids do, because a lot of it, as you say, is kind of the typical stuff, and then they come and
yes.
surprise you.
Yes.
And this footage that they did of the ladies, the older women
yes.
in the village,
yes.
talking about what it was like to be gassed. Some
yes.
of them had lost almost their entire families, and they talked
yes.
about this. It was like watching a BBC documentary.
Yes, it was very, very good. I mean, one of the things that a filmmaker realizes is that you have to have something to say. And boy, have they been born into a world, into an environment, into an era where the history has delivered them a big subject right on their plate. And so they dealt with that really, really well, I thought, you know, and beautifully interviewed, as you said.
What do you think the effect was on the kids? I mean, when I first started watching this movie, I couldn't see that these are traumatized kids or the next generation down, because of course they weren't even born when that happened. But
yes.
what could you sense from them of that legacy?
Yes, I think this is this is the crucial question, Mary Charlotte. You'll notice the very first thing I said to them, you know, is, how are you? What's your life like? And they said, we're really happy. And the shock is that even though they're born into a society where so many people lost their lives, I my guess, I'm not an expert, my guess is that they are at least as happy as children in New Mexico or here in Scotland or something like that. Two really senior child psychiatrists have seen this film, one in North America and one here in the UK, and both have said that they think that on balance these children are probably better adjusted to kids who maybe live a more sheltered or protected urban life, because despite all the rubbish and all the tragedy around them, they still get to play with animals every day, they still get to swim in the river, they still have this plenitude, this vast, gorgeous space in which to roam. And so I think at least in their preteen years, I suspect that they are happier little human beings than a lot of our kids are.
The word that comes to mind when you describe that is just freedom. These are free
yes.
children.
Yes. Yes. And the irony, of course, is that they are Kurdish, and they are people who want a nation of their own, and they don't have that, you know. So the adults have a strong sense of not being free, and yet these children have got certainly a lot of stuff which is very valuable to them. And you saw them goofing around and just making animal noises, and they were great fun to be with, you know. And there's something splendid and life-affirming about them despite everything.
What are their prospects for when they get older?
Do you mean employment prospects or psychological?
Leaving the village, staying there?
Yes. Yeah, there are two cities about 2 hours by car from here, Erbil and Sulaymaniyah. And Sulaymaniyah in particular is it's a wonderful big city, very, very cultured. They have, for example, there a TV station where they play world cinema for children, and then the children themselves are film critics. And as a film lover myself, I reflect on the fact that we don't have that, for example, here in Britain. And so close by, there are real opportunities. And the regional government there is investing in industry and infrastructure. The schools are quite good, etc. So there's some real possibility there. However, there is the thing we touched on earlier about gender balance and gender and the fact that it isn't a level playing field for girls. So that's a real concern.
Do you see any of these people, these young people, getting particularly interested in your career, namely filmmaking?
Well, at the I think some of them really liked filmmaking. Quite a few of them really liked filmmaking. And little Mohammed, the boy I mentioned, who made the Boy in the Mud film, I think he'll go far. I have some charities that works with children, and haven't come across a child as talented as him. So when he grows up a bit, I will certainly just keep an eye on him. And if he wants to meet Kurdish filmmakers or international filmmakers, I'll make sure that he gets the opportunity to.
This is such an unusual film. It's a documentary, I guess you might
yes.
call it that, but it's so poetic and personal and beautiful and gentle and very subjective, really. I mean, I don't know your other work, but it seems to have your own heart so vividly apparent in the film. How did you find this way of working?
And thank you for that question. I started, before we made this film, I was saying to people, I'm trying to make the first magic realist documentary. And I've long felt strongly that documentary doesn't only have to be about the facts, the sort of literal world. It can be about the imaginative world, the dream world. It's just a language like any other language, like poetry or painting or fiction film. And so I knew very strongly that I wanted it to have magic realist properties. That's why I filmed a lot of animals, and that's why there's lots of stuff that happens, you know, in reverse motion. I would ask the kids in the morning what they dreamt about the previous night, and then we would try to film their dreams. It was often about flying. They wanted to fly above their village, so we tried to film that. And documentary is, I think, very good at capturing subjective states, the inner world as well as the outer world. And so that's what I tried to do here.
How did they react when they saw the footage that they themselves had shot?
They screamed their heads off and yelled and jumped up and down and laughed. It was pure joyous. I have to tell you that there were quite a few of us there, and for security reasons, for insurance reasons, we had to have security guards. And the security guards were crying when they saw the joy on the kids' faces, and I was crying a lot. I was trying to operate the camera, and it was so moving to see such rapture.
Now, has this film been screened with, I guess, Kurdish subtitles or whatever in the Kurdish part of Iraq?
It hasn't yet. It's quite recent, the film. It's been playing around the world, which is very, very nice. When you make a tiny little film like this, you don't know where it'll play, but it'll play in the Middle East and all over Europe and North America now. And our plan is to let the kids grow up a little bit, maybe another year or two, and then take the film back and whatever. We've been gathering some stuff. You know, the school said they needed some musical instruments and a few other things. So we've been gathering that and raising a little bit of funds. And then we'll go back with a bit of money to help the school and show the film and see what happens. And maybe film some more to see, because these kids, 11, 12 kids, are changing so fast, as you know. And so I'd like to go back when they're maybe 13 and 14 and see how they've changed. I'll remember them. I'm not sure at all that they'll remember me.
How could they not remember you? You brought E.T. and the red balloon.
Well, you never know. Hopefully they will, but it doesn't matter. You know, that I think that a child's imaginative life is like an Aladdin's cave. It's so rich and full of treasures that I know I'll be planted in there somewhere, like some little rough rhinestone somewhere, you know, but there'll be so many other things going on that I think that, you know, that somebody said once that you make art or you make films not to speak but to listen, and I felt that I really listened when I was there and got so much from those kids, you know, so whether they got anything from me is another matter.
I can, well, as a viewer of the film, one knows that they did. I mean, they also got the opportunity to make a movie and to reflect on themselves in a way that probably they had never done before. And not to mention the effect that had on themselves, on their parents,
yes,
on that whole village.
Yes. Certainly seeing yourself on a big screen, you know, that must be amazing, you know, if you're a little human being and then in a village where there's no lighting, and suddenly this guy brings along this machine and it projects an incredibly bright, luminous image, and then there you are in the image. That must be memorable in some way, I think, you know. It's the brightness. I was struck by the luminosity of cinema when I was there. A great feeling.
The film is called The First Movie, and it opens this Friday, the 3rd of June, at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts, here in Santa Fe. They are on the web at ccasantafe.org. Mark Cousins is the filmmaker. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's a pleasure, Mary Charlotte, and I think I'm Skyping in after that screening on Friday night, so I'll be on the screen for the audience, as far as I believe, and I can answer any questions.
Wonderful. Good. Well, thanks.
Not at all. Real pleasure.
I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program Elena Zachary and Nicholas Ballas. They are doing a reading of a play called I Take Your Hand in Mine this Sunday, the 5th of June at Collected Works Bookstore at 3 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, nice to be here, Mary Charlotte.
Lovely to be here.
Always.
Thanks.
It's now, is this a play or is it meant to be a reading, the kind of reading that you're doing?
It's a play.
It is. So mm-hmm. This can be fully staged.
Some call it a spear, some call it an arrow. No, my understanding is it is meant to be a play. We are doing it as a reading, and it conforms because it's another epistolary project, you might say.
So which you have been doing a whole series
of. A whole series
at
Collected
Works Collected Bookstore.
Works.
So these are plays that two people can read. We, the audience, sit there basically watching you reading, listening, and it is quite amazing how gripping it is and how visual it is, because the visuals are in the imagination of the people who are listening.
Oh, good. I'm glad you got that.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
So the play is about the playwright Anton Chekhov and his wife, Olga Knippe, who is a German actress who starred in these Chekhov plays in Moscow. And they were together for a fairly short time, mm-hmm. because Chekhov died young, mm-hmm. but they lived lifetime's worth of love, passion, art, togetherness, apartness.
Lots of apartness.
Right.
Lots of apartness, which is why there's so many letters.
Right. And a lot of drama and a lot of romance in writing.
Right.
If not,
if you marry
indeed.
An actress, expect drama and romance.
And if you marry
is
a writer,
true,
expect drama. Expect to be amused.
And what wonderful characters they are. They are, well, in the play, which I have to say is beautifully composed by a playwright who I guess was a translator of Russian, a scholar, mm-hmm. and took these letters and basically made fragments of them into dialogue, which is incredibly, I think, probably difficult. I did it very skillfully.
There's a lovely arc to it. Carol Rocamora is the Russian scholar who wrote this play, and she was encouraged by no one less than Olympia Dukakis, whom we know from Moonstruck, among other things. Mm-hmm. I knew her as an actress in the city, and also her husband, Louis Zorich. So they inspired her to do this, and Carol Rocamora translated freshly these letters and then created this wonderful play based upon the true relationship. And I wanted to add Olga Knipper, whom I did not know until I read the play, was the star of the Moscow Art Theater. She was a huge, huge star before Chekhov ever entered the scene, though she was already starring in his plays but had not met him, mm-hmm. and plays by Gorky and others. So she was already as successful in her milieu as Chekhov was in his.
Right, right. And I think she saw the writing on the wall. No pun intended. But that this was really the where she wanted to hitch her wagon.
But he was also so attractive.
Well, that too, but you can't see that on this radio thing, so we won't talk about that.
All right.
trust
radio
me.
Radio is theater of the imagination,
listeners.
You know that.
Well, and so is this play.
Right. Uh-huh.
Right.
Now, the drama takes place around the very beginning of the 20th century, mm-hmm. and he is away from Moscow, particularly during the winter, because of his health.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he had tuberculosis, and he ended up dying of tuberculosis emphysema. He was a doctor, too, so he was in this whole process of kind of trying to self-heal, but with not much success, and there wasn't sufficient... there weren't sufficient drugs to treat him and to keep him alive, so basically it was a kind of foregone conclusion that I think he was constantly aware of, and I think that added to the passion of not only his writing but his relationship with Olga.
No time to waste.
That's right, yeah.
And meanwhile, they couldn't be in Moscow. He couldn't be in Moscow because he was sick, and she couldn't be with him in Yalta.
That's exactly
because
right.
She was playing seven nights a week, mm-hmm. and living this incredibly intense life, both of theater and of champagne and caviar and restaurants, and basically being a superstar.
La 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 la.
And what is it that attracted you to this role?
No, yeah. It was the passion, the relationship,
yes,
yeah, and also the wonderful. The sadness of it, you know, it was piquant because mm-hmm. they had to bring everything to bear in such a short time. And she consistently, through the play, says to him, I'm going to give up theater. Should I give up theater? I should have given up theater. Well, would she ever have? She wouldn't have been who she was if she hadn't been an actor.
Right, absolutely. I mean, they learned a tremendous amount from each other. I think he learned about the internal process of the theater from her. I think what attracted him was her raw emotions, because he was an intellectual. He worked.
Mm-hmm.
He was
mm-hmm.
he was a craftsman. He worked very, very carefully on his plays. He worked them and then overworked them and then did them again. Until they came out absolutely perfect in his own heart and mind.
Chekhov is the standard to me of all that is pure about theater, for that very, very reason.
Of the writing of it, but as I was, you know, the point I'm trying to make is that he was deeply attracted to her, I believe, because of her raw power
mm-hmm.
of emotion,
mm-hmm.
and that may have been something that he didn't have. I mean, he was writing short stories, which were fascinating short stories. They were award-winning short stories. They were highly recognized. But to write drama, to write something that can live on stage, I think he needed her deeply.
They each had something that the other
It was
lacked.
Symbiotic. It was brilliant. It was symbiotic. Yeah, right.
When I was a student in college for all of this, Chekhov was the standard by which all things were measured that were true. You would say that anything that happened in a Chekhov play was deeply, deeply important. If it was a chair falling over, mm-hmm. and never a word was wasted. Mm-hmm. So whenever I have taught, you know, and I in my audition classes and my acting classes, you learn from Chekhov respect for the word, mm-hmm. that every word was crafted, even though they're English translations, and you must respect that. And I think all playwrights deserve that respect.
Sure. Well, the ones that are deserving.
Well,
some of them.
I mean, to have a more innocent approach.
Well, that kind of. I mean, there's so many different kinds of, and this is true for literature as well. There's people who write sprawling passages of prose or drama, and then there's some who, for as you say, there's a kind of distillation where every word is so carefully chosen. Mm-hmm. And this play, now we don't hear. Chekhov's. Well, we hear a little bit of the,
we do.
The
there
words
are little
from
quotes
from
Seagull sure. and Three mm-hmm. Sisters and Cherry
quotes.
Orchard too, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
But
mm-hmm.
we hear mostly the words from their letters.
Mostly
yes.
the letters, right?
Do you want to read just a little,
oh, yes.
a little fragment,
a little soupçon?
Sure.
We're talking right. about the play "I Take Your Hand in Mine" that's being performed this Sunday at Collected Works Bookstore. You're going to read a section from. Kind of the
very
toward,
early
toward
on
the beginning.
Very early on.
Early
yes.
on as they were just meeting, getting to know each other.
That first letter, the first of so many.
I take your hand in mine, dear actress.
At the time, he was building his house in Yalta. His doctors were banishing him to the south, and he had to leave his beloved Melikovo. The consumption was progressing.
She was rehearsing in Moscow. I journeyed south to Yalta on the train.
You've only been gone 4 days, and already I need to write you. I know it's too soon, but I can't help myself. Saturday evening, my favorite. The sound of the church bells is so peaceful.
Oh, you sentimental German, you.
I was so sad at the station when you left. I felt like crying all the way home. Your sister was here yesterday. How nice of her.
Checking up on you.
How was the journey?
Fine, fine. My companion let me take the lower berth. I ate everything in the basket. No boiling water on the train for tea, though. Arrived at my house in Yalta last evening. It's so quiet here. I sat indoors, thinking of you. My dear, dear actress. If only you knew what pleasure your letters give me. I bow low before you. Very low. So low, in fact, that my brow touches the bottom of a well 8 fathoms deep.
Thanks for the photographs and the sweets and for your letters, too. I was so distraught, I thought you didn't want to write to me. This morning, we rehearsed Uncle Vanya. Tonight, I play Arkadin on the Seagull. Stanislavski can't come to Vanya rehearsals. He's directing Ivan the Terrible. How is he going to play Ostrov if he's not at rehearsal?
Good luck. He's not a bad director, but he's a terrible actor.
We love that that the beloved Stanislavski, teacher to many of us, takes a lot of hits in this play.
We can be catty about Stanislavski.
Well, and the thing is, I mean, all of these, you know, we tend to think of the history of art, the history of drama, of literature, is kind of lives of the saints, and in fact, they were all flawed.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, she doesn't answer many of his questions, but rather goes on about, I played until 4 o'clock in the morning, and then I went to sleep, and then I got up at 3 o'clock and had eggs and champagne and came to the theater where there were buckets and buckets of flowers, and how are you, you know? Mm. She really thrived in that voluptuous, privileged. I mean, she was the star in the Moscow Art Theater. She was it.
Which is not to say she didn't treat Chekhov well, because from these letters,
oh,
it seemed that she
did. Of course.
Oh, they were deeply devoted. Deeply, deeply devoted. Yeah. And I think they found a way to get into each other's hearts in a really miraculous way, that they were necessary to each other.
I have to say, and the reason, ladies and gentlemen in Radio Land, that you're not hearing dishes clanking in the background is because I'm not at the Santa Fe Baking Company. I've recorded this a day in advance, and I'm at the rehearsal space having just seen the rehearsal. And I have to say, and this happens a lot for readings, I don't know if it's because I'm a radio person, but I love that we don't see the drama, mm-hmm. that we create it in our minds. Mm-hmm. And it's the kind of play that I think is kind of better this way, because otherwise you'd have to have some kind of split screen or something with her in Moscow and him in Yalta and all that
right,
kind of stuff.
Right. I think it really focuses on the word. And
oh,
the words
yes.
is so carefully chosen. I think the playwright did a brilliant job of picking specific passages which have a lot of import and a lot of juiciness in the word. And not having a fully staged, fully realized situation forces the audience to listen very carefully. Mm-hmm. And as you said, radio does the same thing, but in this case, here you are, and you're able to suspend disbelief and to just hear what the heart, what words the heart mm-hmm. is given.
And then we get to juice them up because
yeah,
we're
we do.
Actors.
Yeah, we do.
Well, and when I was thinking about the when an actor has to play a role, let's say you have to be a dock worker or an archaeologist, that's not something that you know, but being writers and actors, you know this, and so there must be a kind of familiarity.
I didn't think of that.
Oh.
She's right. I guess it's obvious.
Pretty much, it's
oh,
there.
Oh, wow.
The play is called I Take Your Hand in Mine, Elena Zachary and Nicholas Ballas. Once again, they will be doing a reading of this play. It's a series of these two-hander play readings at Collected Works Bookstore, and it'll be this Sunday, the 5th of June, at 3 in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's
Thank
our pleasure.
You so
Thank
much.
You, Mary Charlotte.
I'd like now to welcome to the program filmmaker Libby Spears. She will be screening and speaking about her documentary, Playground, this Friday, the 3rd of June, at Tipton Hall at 6 in the evening, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a film about the sexual exploitation of children and teenagers, and we've talked on this program before about sex trafficking in other countries. But what your film brings out is that both the victims and the perpetrators involved in child sex abuse and prostitution and so on are, in very large part, Americans. Was this surprising to you?
It was actually quite shocking. I started out filming in places that we're all familiar with, that we know trafficking is happening, you know, all over the developing world, in Cambodia, Vietnam. Our first location with a camera was actually Indonesia right after the tsunami. But what happened was, you know, when you're making a documentary, part of the process is, you know, you go out and film, and then you go back and you fundraise. And we were back in the States to fundraise, and haphazardly met someone who suggested that I speak with Ernie Allen, who runs the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And at the time, there was some press in the New York Times Magazine about children that were being trafficked into the country from Mexico. And when I met with Ernie to sort of find out, like, okay, let's hear about more stories of kids being trafficked into the country, he said, you know, I don't have any other stories of kids being trafficked into the country, but I have several hundred thousand of kids being trafficked across state lines. Where do you want to start? And so that was quite shocking because I had no idea that it was happening in our own backyard.
A lot of these young people seem to be from abusive homes and from the foster care system, in which there's also a lot of sexual abuse. What is, and this is part of the film, what is the psychology of people who abuse and violate these children?
I mean, that's a big question, and I don't think there's one neat answer for it. You know, obviously with kids that are in the foster care system that don't, you know, aren't being raised in a home with their birth-given parents, and they're basically wards of the state, they're not getting, you know, most of the time, not all the time, they're just not getting the same sort of care and supervision that most kids get. And unfortunately, that makes that particular population a lot more vulnerable. And a lot of these kids that are in the foster care system, you know, were abused prior to even going into foster care. And so it seems like this, you know, this sort of vicious cycle. And you know, unfortunately, again, there are a lot of really great foster parents, but, you know, I also came across a lot of stories of people that, in terms of the perpetrator side, they saw that as an opportunity, you know, adopting kids in their home that they could actually take advantage of, because they're not, no one's really protecting them in the way that they should be protected.
And I was thinking about the people who were screening these foster parents. I guess it's something that's just very hard to screen for.
You know, I think it is, and I think it again, this varies from state to state, but I know that, you know, when I was in Oregon, one of the social workers I was interviewing, I asked her on camera, you know, so tell me about that, the process of screening for a foster parent. And she said, turn your camera off. And so I turned the camera off, and she handed me a document that was about 3 pages long, and she was like, just skip to the end and sign your name, and I'll give you a kid in 14 days. So I think there's definitely, the foster care system is something we really, really need to vamp, and I hate to say that it's broken, but I think it is, and I don't mean that in a way that's hopeless. I think it can be fixed, but I think it's something that we really, really need to dig deeply into and improve a great deal, because I think, again, as you saw in the film, a large number of these kids are coming, you know, from our foster care system.
To what extent is law enforcement able to track and prosecute these crimes, and to what extent has the definition of what constitutes a crime been changed or caught up with the reality?
I mean, up until, you know, recently, actually just in the last year, there was no federal legislation that protected domestic victims of child sex trafficking. Now, there are laws that have been in effect since 2000, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, that protected foreign victims of trafficking. You know, and the irony of that is just the numbers we see on average each year. There's not even a number for minors, but for adults, approximately 17,000 people that are trafficked into the country, and that's both, you know, sex and labor. And we actually have very good laws, federal laws, but in terms of domestic and specific to minors, there was nothing. And about a year, last year, Senator Wyden and Conran both co-sponsored a bill after seeing Playground at the home of Senator Boxer in D.C. Literally from that screening, walked out of the room and said, "We're gonna sponsor a bill," and they did. And they introduced the Victims Protection Act for domestic victims a year ago, and it actually didn't pass. It just sort of got lost in the shuffle of healthcare and everything else. And then this year, it was just reintroduced in March. And so hopefully that will be voted on and we'll have some federal legislation, because there are other laws they can, you know, law enforcement could be charging people with child rape, you know, under, you know, just sexual exploitation of a minor. But I think there's a certain perception that has to change, because what's happening is a lot of these kids are not being seen as victims. So it's great. We do need to change laws. But on top of that, we need to also focus on education and awareness, you know, especially for law enforcement, because a lot of the times they're first contact with these kids. And if they don't see these kids as victims, which a lot of times they don't, it doesn't matter what the laws say, because a lot of what's happening right now is the kids are actually being arrested and charged with prostitution. And the what we call the Johns, or essentially the abusers, are walking away.
Both the Johns and the pimps. I mean, it is absolutely frightening and horrifying in your film to see police stopping 13-year-old girls who, especially in the context of the film, are clearly victims of circumstance, and a lot of them can't get out of that life even if they want to. They're drawn into it in one way or another. Sometimes there's drugs or promises or all kinds of things, and then if they try to leave, they're exploited even worse.
Exactly, and again, I think a lot of that, you've got two issues. One is education awareness and, you know, changes in legislation on federal level and state level. I mean, the federal level, I think we're in good shape, and I think this will pass. But then we've got to look at states. And as of now, I think it's only 4 states that actually have laws designed to prosecute pimps and Johns under these trafficking, domestic minor trafficking laws. So we have a long way to go on state level. And then also changing, again, what I mentioned before is just public perception and perception of law enforcement who come across these kids. And then even the people in law enforcement who are educated and they are aware and they really do want to help these kids, and there's a lot of good police officers who do want to help these kids, the problem is there's nowhere to put them. So, for example, in this country, if we have an estimated 300,000 victims, minor victims of trafficking per year, currently there are only 75 beds in the country. So the other problem proposes, you know, law enforcement will say, well, if we don't arrest these girls and take them in, then they're going to be back on the street and going to go right back to their pimp. And so what we need is a place to put these girls. And the problem is there's just not enough long-term shelters in the country right now to take care of them.
Does this legislation that's being proposed provide for that at all?
It does. The federal piece, if it passes, I believe it allots $2.5 million per year that will go towards a number of things, one being shelter, and that's that would be for 5 years. And then, you know, again, if you focus on the state legislation, there would be money in that as well.
It's extraordinary that, I mean, we have statutory rape laws where if an 18-year-old guy has sex with his 17-year-old girlfriend, she's underage and he can go to jail. But if a John has sex with a 13-year-old girl for money, then he's not liable?
Yeah, there's something that happens when money gets involved, because you're right. It's very, very clear when there's no money exchange that, yes, if you know, you have a 40-something-year-old man that has sex with a 14-year-old girl, no matter what state you're in, which it's complicated in this country because every state has a different age of consent, you know, that is statutory rape or child rape, depending on the state you're in. But, you know, I'll tell you an interesting scenario that when we were filming in Oregon, we were out with two officers who we were in the area of prostitution, and we see this girl at 2 o'clock in the morning, and this girl literally looked like she was 10 years old. In an area that she didn't look like she fit in. And one of the officers said, oh, let's go check on her. And the other officer said, wait, let's wait until she gets a date. And this is when I first started filming, and I was a bit confused. And what happened is instead of going and checking on this girl and saying, hey, like, what are you doing out here? Let's see some ID. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. Let's take you home. They pulled over, and they waited until some guy in his 40s or 50s pulled over. She got in the car with him and had sex with him. Then they pulled up. They arrested the girl, who ended up being 12 years old, took her to juvenile detention, and didn't even get any information on the John or much less look for the pimp. So I agree with you. My first reaction was like, wait a minute, isn't there a statutory rape charge, even without the trafficking laws, if those don't exist in Oregon? So can't you arrest him for statutory rape or child rape? And again, the response is that when... The response was, she's a prostitute. But, you know, I think that's one big paradigm shift that needs to happen to really change this issue, is that we need to stop using that word when it pertains to children, because, you know, according to our laws in this country, being the age of consent, if you're a minor, you cannot consent to sex. It doesn't matter if there's money, whatever is involved. That's the way our laws are designed. So you can't ever say that that child is a willing participant unless you want to change the age of consent to 11. So that's one thing we have to stop doing, is we shouldn't be calling children. Children are never, you know, prostitutes. They're being sexually exploited.
We're talking to Libby Spears about her film Playground. Another thing that was new to me was the prostitution that happens in airports, like Atlanta was one of the examples in your film. What's going on there?
Well, I think Atlanta specifically is a hub. And I think, as you saw, I think the date was, you know, child prostitution was like or child trafficking was like a $50 misdemeanor. Up until just a few years ago, somebody would get a ticket for $50 for trafficking a minor. And I think with Atlanta, because it's, you know, a large city, you have a lot of people traveling internationally, you know, which you also have other cities, you know, that fit that bill as well, so does New York and Los Angeles, but for some reason, I'm not sure why Atlanta, but it seemed to be a bigger problem there. And it also seems sort of ironic, it being in the South and the Bible Belt, that this was so pervasive. But, you know, and it's hard to say because we didn't film in cities like New York and Atlanta, so I really can't, I mean, New York and Los Angeles, so I can only speak to Atlanta, but you know, we spent a lot of time in the family court there, and that's where a lot of those cases were being uncovered. You know, you would have a child being brought in, you know, under neglect, or children that were being charged with these sort of petty crimes, and it would come out through that case that the child had actually, you know, had a pimp and was being trafficked, and this pimp was sort of encouraging the child to do anything, whether it was from sell drugs or break into a house or whatever it was. But they were finding a lot of the victims through the actual family court.
It's funny, it's not at all ironic to me that these things happen in the Bible Belt, because those are the places where there's so much hypocrisy about sex in the first place, and where there's such a higher use of pornography, and where these abstinence programs result in higher cases of STDs and things like that. And I think one of the things that your film brings out is that frank discussions about sex and sexuality are absolutely essential to looking at this problem in the face and beginning to do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, one of the organizations, or actually a parent who started an organization because her daughter was trafficked at age 12, Diane Salden, who has an organization in Canada. It's interesting because we've been trying to figure out with the film, you know, it's great that we're showing it to the adult population, but we really need to get to the kids and use the film as a prevention tool by showing it to, you know, appropriate age kids that are in high school. And we've been hitting a lot of barriers with that. And we're willing to even edit the film and make changes and cut down the time of it. But, you know, Diane, who's in Canada, they actually use our film. They screen it, the film, in middle schools. And again, a very different attitude in Canada around sex, like you're speaking of, than in the United States. You know, we've taken out sex education where, on one hand, you know, we avoid the conversation altogether, but, you know, if you live in any city, or if you have an American Apparel store where you live, you know, walk into the store and you're just being bombarded with sex from billboards to magazine covers. So it's not something that we can avoid talking about with our children, because if we don't talk to them about it, somebody else is, and that's the person that we don't want talking to our children about it.
Now, I think everyone knows at this point that there's a huge internet pornography industry, including child pornography, but something that was new to me watching your film was that there is an internet industry of videos of children being abused. That is a market. And as one of the speakers in your film points out, this is not sex. This is like crime scene videos.
Yes. Again, something we, you know, one of the most difficult parts about the film is trying to find that balance. And, you know, there's not a lot you can show on the topic of sexual exploitation. But we also wanted the audience to be clear that this is a real problem. You know, as Michelle Collins said in the film from the National Center of Missing and Exploited Children, that these aren't children in bathtubs. These are children that are being raped and abused. And she referenced one of the websites that they found, which was called childrape.com. And I think, you know, again, that was probably one of the more disturbing moments for me. You know, they have an entire staff, just to give you an idea of how bad the problem is. They have about a dozen people that all they do 24/7 is filter through these child rape sites. And they're also, these sites are very, very hard to track. It's very, very hard to track the people who have set them up, and they're hard cases to prosecute.
Watching the film, one gets a sense that, okay, there's a huge necessity of law enforcement, more abilities, more staff, stronger laws to find and prosecute these people. And there's also a tremendous need for facilities and resources for these girls, mostly girls, to actually heal and try to start a new life, which is also not easy, as we see in the film. But there's yet another question, which is, how have we, and I know it's not just a U.S. problem, it's a worldwide problem, but how have we gotten so sick that this is such a huge, prevalent problem?
Again, it's a big question, and I think a part of it is what you referenced earlier, and you definitely see it in the film, is I think if you go back to the issue, you know, it's a lot, the issue is a lot like domestic violence, in that, you know, how I think we've made a lot of progress in that area, but it's still not, the problem isn't resolved. And the same thing with child exploitation. It's like that was an issue that was hardly, and it's still difficult to talk about, but I feel like we're at least talking about it a bit more. And then you add the component of the money and the trafficking, and it becomes more complicated. And I think it makes the problem worse. I have seen changes in other countries. I mean, we spent a lot of time in Cambodia, for example, one of the first countries we filmed in, and I've gone back since. And no, the problem's not solved. It hasn't stopped, but it has largely improved. I mean, the first time I went there in 2005, you could literally see, there were literally streets in Phnom Penh where children were lined each side of the street. And these perpetrators that would come largely from the U.S. and Germany would come in and just tap a kid on the head, and then they would pay the trafficker, and it was just very open transactions. That doesn't exist anymore. You know, since I've been back, you don't see it. Yes, it still happens, but it's not as open as it was, and they definitely have made some improvements. And I think what's where we are in America is, again, the tendency is to point the finger at other countries with this type of problem. Like, no, of course we don't have this problem here, but we do. And the problem is, you know, I feel like it's getting worse because we've sort of neglected just the issue of child exploitation so long. It's now it's sort of manifested into this whole other arena of now it's not just exploiting children, but now people can make a profit from it.
Libby Spears is a filmmaker. Her documentary is called Playground. It screens this Friday, the 3rd of June, at Tipton Hall at 6 o'clock, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute, sfai.org. Libby, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.